To the 9-8 podcast, the home of everything progressive and underground right here in Australia. My name is David Ellis, and every show I'm joined by the illustrious man from the Western Coast, Mr. Alex Hogg. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing well as well. It's a lovely sunny day here in Perth, 31 degrees, enjoying it immensely. And laughing at the cyclones and such that they're having over in Sydney at the moment.
It really is like the four horsemen of the apocalypse.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm just wondering who Pestilence is.
Yeah. Anyway.
Look, before we jump into today's show, a quick reminder to everyone listening that if you aren't subscribed already, please follow or subscribe to the podcast wherever it is that you are listening. Leave us a review and share this show with your prog-minded friends. It greatly helps us to expand the reach of the show. Now, first things first here, a little bit of follow-up on the John Myung interview that we released very recently. You had a little bit of a question in here about the question that I asked him about public profile.
Yeah, well, the question you asked was actually a question that I came up with. I was trying to figure out with him whether it was a conscious decision to, like, maintain a low public profile in the sort of, you know, like the Neil Peart sort of thing, right? Where they don't, you know, they're not out there on social media. But I don't know. I kind of felt like he took it as almost like a dig. You know, that the other guys are doing projects and making stuff and doing things. And I was like, geez, I hope it didn't come off that he thought we were having a dig at him.
No, absolutely not.
It really wasn't a dig. It was.
No. And that was the thing. Like, but the question that I posed was basically, hey, these guys are always in the limelight. Why aren't you? You know, and not in a you should be doing it more often kind of thing. It's just like, is it genuine reason? Like, is it a case of, and a lot of people do this, a lot of famous people and celebrities and so on and so forth, you know, they steer clear of the limelight because of their, you know, their family, or, you know, they've got young kids and they don't want the paparazzi following them around all the time. So they just stay out of it.
There's part of that as well, but then there's also just like they've made a study of maintaining like a low profile. They're just like, I just don't. You know, they're shy, or they're just reserved people, thinking of sports, you know, like the four-time Formula One world champion Sebastian Vettel. He's very much made a study of a low profile. Like, you never see him out with his wife or his kids anywhere. They've just like, no, we're gonna, and I think that was sort of influenced by his idol, you know, the seven-time Formula World One champion Michael Schumacher. He always, you know, and even more so now after his horrible injury where he sort of cracked his skull open skiing. And it's just like, once I heard that had happened, I'm like, okay, you're never going to see or hear from him ever again. That's it. No. He's just like, nope. Like, he always maintained a low public profile, even at the height of his fame in Formula One. It was just like, and after that happened, it was like, okay, this is going to go even, it's going to go underground now. You're never going to see him anywhere.
Yeah.
And so far, it's like, people haven't. So, and I just wonder if he'd made a study of it, or was like, you know, an idea that, you know, this is the way I want to be, but it sounds like not really. Like,
yeah,
it's not really been a conscious choice of his to kind of maintain that, or
I don't know. I mean, that was kind of the vibe that I was getting. But as well as that, I mean, he's a pretty humble guy. He's a pretty, you know, spiritual sort of guy as well. So, you know, it very well could also be just the case that he's just not really chasing that kind of stuff. And it's not like I'm not chasing that, so therefore I'm not going to go for it, conscious decision. It's just never been part of that, of his idea. But I do genuinely hope it wasn't taken as a dig, because we certainly didn't mean it as a dig. So yeah, but anyway, he's certainly got a lot coming up, so we will be hearing
more. I mean, I don't, like I said, I don't think I've heard anyone sort of talk about or speak about his, you know, the thing with the pedal or the thing with the combo amp. I don't think I've ever heard anyone. It's not been, not seen any announcements. It's certainly not been something that, you know, I've even seen Dream Theater post about on their social media channels yet.
Absolutely. Yeah, I haven't seen any announcements of it anywhere.
Which is really weird because I'd have thought that'd be something that they'd be pushing, you know. Ooh, you know, check out this new bass gear and he's used it on the new record, which, by the way, is out at the end of this week sort of thing, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, yeah, it's interesting.
It's an odd one.
Yeah.
So I think that about wraps it up there for the follow-up. So I think we'll jump into the news. We've got a couple of pieces of news here this week for various reasons. I mean, obviously, the whole of this show, most of the show is going to be taken up by the new Dream Theater record. We're going to go track by track on that. But first, I thought, originally, this episode we were going to do, which would have gone out a couple of days ago, was going to be about the new Devin Townsend record, the Puzzle Stroke Snuggles record. But that's been postponed. Now, I only found out about after the record was supposed to be out already that it had been postponed.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, not cool. No. But usually with these, okay, we understand that, like, vinyl's really hard to produce right now and there's all sorts of problems with shipping and stuff and people are going wild thinking they're not going to have a Christmas this year because nothing's being able to be shipped around because of the pandemic. Yeah. But I'd have thought someone would have at least had someone like, hey, you know, we're going to postpone the record. I mean, it's like a sign of the times, which is really strange, you know, thinking about how the podcast sort of started 4 years ago and what we were talking about then. Like, I was genuinely bummed that I wasn't even able to pre-save the record on a streaming service. That wasn't even an option available to me. And I'm like, that's, you know, really weird optics. And two, how the scene has changed so much that we're, like, actively going out and pre-saving stuff on streaming services now.
Absolutely. And I think it's just, it was possibly just oversight, right? I mean, with everything that's going on at the moment, I mean, countries are reopening. I'm sure that Devin is, you know, knee deep in trying to figure out where he's going to be touring and all that kind of stuff, trying to make some money.
Where he's
back
allowed to tour. I mean, and obviously, like, he's in Canada, so there's all sorts of, like, weird, funny rules about where you can and can't. Like, where you can and can't play and who needs to be vaccinated and when and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want to dive deeper into that, just go and have a look at what's going on in the NBA right now. I mean, that in itself is just a microcosm of the whole situation, which is not this podcast, so we're going to skip past that for the minute.
Absolutely. But it is, I mean, obviously there's a lot going on, but a bit weird that it was announced 4 days after it was supposed to be announced, so...
It was supposed to come out, and then they said, oh, yeah, it's going to be delayed for a couple of weeks. So, I mean, they've already delayed it once. We saw what happened with the Haken record, but that got delayed twice, three times. I don't even know how many times it got delayed. I don't know. That's why I haven't said when it's coming out, because I don't even know if it's going to come out then. You know, yeah. Who knows?
Yeah, no, I understand that. In completely unrelated news, Tears for Fears have announced a new album. And they've released a new song from it called The Tipping Point. Have you heard it? Have you managed to catch up on it and have a listen?
I did have a listen to it, yeah. I mean, the first thing that caught me was, like, that intro sound, that synthy part, sounds like the opening to The Leavers by Marillion. It really does. That sort of, you know, that I don't know what kind of sound. It's sort of like a synthesized xylophone or something. That's kind of what it sounds like. Yeah, it was a big, big reverb on the vocals. You know, there's that huge sound there. It's a nice song. I liked it. What about you, Dave? What do you think?
Yeah, I loved it. I mean, I'm sure they're going to love this comparison, but, you know, that drum beat sounds like the drum beat from Everybody Wants to Rule the World, that kind of ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta kind of drum beat.
I'm sure they'll love that. They got to love that comparison.
Oh, well, don't make a song that is so catchy that everyone's singing it like 30 years later. I mean, Jesus, guys. Yeah.
Stop using the catchy beats, man.
Yeah. but I quite liked it, actually. I'm pretty excited for the new album, to be honest with you. I'm a big Tears for Fears fan, so... I'm excited. I'm really looking forward to it. Something else I saw online, the Caped Crusader Collector Club, and you've got it here in the notes. Something to do with Rick Wakeman, and it looks really interesting. Tell us about it.
It is. I mean, first thing, good thing there's no synonym for club that starts with a P, because CCCP is not a fun acronym for a membership club. If you've got no idea what I'm on about because you weren't alive in the 1980s and or didn't marry someone from the Eastern Bloc, just go and Google it. You'll figure it out. You're smart people.
Yeah.
Now, this thing isn't cheap, okay? Let's cut to the chase here. It's $250 Australian dollars a year, but I think that's a pretty fair price for what you're getting for the outlay.
Mm.
I mean, an individually numbered membership card, a signed welcome letter by Rick Wakeman. If you're the sort of person who doesn't already have multiple signed things by Rick Wakeman in your household already, but whatever. An exclusive yearbook full of rare photos, articles, and memorabilia from Rick's personal archive. A sticker, and you get some photos as well. Now, the membership runs from January to December, which will also include an exclusive CD release each quarter, which would be good to see if they actually turn up each quarter. I mean, I'm still waiting for a prog magazine that I ordered 6 months ago, but I know that's not their fault. Their shipping distribution network is a joke. That's another topic for another day. But now, if you sign up before the end of this year, 2021, you get a bonus 3 months tacked onto your membership. So you get 15 months for the price of 12. You also get 10% off in Rick Wakeman's memorabilia shop, invites to member-only events, and early access to tickets where possible. Now, I've been to one of these speaking events when he released his one of his records. I think it was Piano Variations, I think. He did one of these Q&As at an HMV on Oxford Street in London, and that was hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
One of his friends was there to compare, and, you know, Rick tells funny stories and does his usual bit. If you haven't heard the interview that we did with Rick Wakeman on his most recent record, The Red Planet, I'll throw that in the show notes, because that's a really fun interview that I had the great fortune to be able to do. I figure many people who are listening to this episode would probably enjoy Rick's music, so if you can and you're interested, link in the description for that one.
Absolutely. It would be... it certainly sounds interesting, if not for, you know, the unreleased stuff, you know, which I'm sure is probably going to wind up on a backwater somewhere, some backwater website, someone's uploaded it.
I'm sure it will.
Just don't be a dick and buy it and support Rick, so...
Totally. I mean, I did see some comments, and some of them are pretty fair comments of like, well, if this stuff wasn't good enough to release at the time, why is it good enough to release now? And, well, there's probably something to that, I think.
Well, I think in the famous words of Mr. Krabs, because money!
That's certainly part of it as well, but it, like, the live stuff can be interesting things. If it's like, oh, I found a tape of a live show I did back in the 80s or the 70s or whatever, yeah, that stuff can be interesting to hear. But yeah, I think that there's a point that, like, it's the same thing with like the box sets and stuff, and like, am I interested in listening to 43 demos of the same song? No, I don't know, but that's just a personal thing. I know people really like that stuff, but it's not something that I'm particularly interested in. Just weirdos. The demo sort of thing. I don't know. I'd rather listen to the record as itself as rather than demos, but that's just me.
No, I agree with you. I mean, some demos can be really interesting, right? Particularly the ones where they release it and it's like, oh, you can hear parts. And it's like, oh, okay, so that later became a different part of another song, or it turned into another song, then they cut it from that demo piece, you know? Or it can be interesting just to hear how the artists actually sort of work through and what the different variants were as it came along. You know, what was the different versions of the solo? What was the different versions of the vocal lines, you know, the melodies and all that sort of stuff? It's interesting to hear the evolution of that, but you're not going to do it for every bloody song. You know what I mean? And if you are, then, I mean, hey, hats off to you. I mean, you're a super duper fan at that point, but...
I think this particular one, this Cape Crusaders Collector Club is definitely aimed more at like the diehards and the real hardcore fans. I think that's
the $250 a year subscription would probably have given that away.
That's true. No casual fan is going to lash out that much money if they're not like super into the thing. Yeah that's absolutely. A fair point.
But look, it's certainly worth a look, I think. So, yeah. I think that about wraps up the news, though.
It does, it does. I mean, let's not keep the good people waiting. Let's jump straight into the main topic. And frankly, why I suspect most of you are listening to the show anyway, for like hot takes on Dream Theater Records the day they put, the day they put them out. Now, for the record, just a bit of an open disclosure here, we are recording this episode a week before it's before the record is officially released.
Mm-hmm.
So there's probably, if something drastically does change or they miraculously put a third single out that we haven't heard about yet,
mm-hmm.
there might be a bit of a, you know, some of the stuff we say here might be maybe slightly dated, but we'll try our best to not have to do that too much.
Absolutely.
And the other thing is, as well, as we put a shout out to our Dream Theater Fan Club of Australia and New Zealand homepage and said to people, ask questions of us, you know, what do you want to know about the record that's coming out? And so we've taken all of those questions, we've worked them into our review here, and so we're going to kick this one off with the opening track, The Alien. Now, we spoke about this record, this song already when it was the lead-off, and a question here from Carl McLeish, which is, what tracks do you think are going to have the biggest live appeal? Now, I think this song is pretty much a classic Dream Theater opener. I mean, we did describe it on the previous episode as like the safe one.
Yeah.
And it's a song I can imagine they'd open the shows on tour with. You know, it's a complex, ever shifting instrumental passage at the opening, breaking out into a melodic solo. We'll come back to that bit in a minute later.
Mm.
I can hear the crowds roar when the spotlight comes to shine on John. You know, there's all this intricate moving, flashing lights, and then bang, it opens up, and then the spotlight focuses on John while he's playing that solo.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you on that. It is an opening track. I mean, you think of all of the times that you've seen Dream Theater and that I've seen Dream Theater. You know, the most punchy openings, I mean, the first time was the Chaos in Motion World Tour, and that was the, I think that was the Thus Spoke Zarathustra intro, straight into Constant Motion, and that was, you know, lights on John, playing that riff, and then straight into it. The next time was A Nightmare to Remember, so that was pretty much all lights up and everyone doing it. Time after that was The Enemy Inside,
which we didn't get the tour opening one on the backs of Angels. We didn't get that.
No, we didn't. But we got that one. We got the Enemy Inside, and that was, you know, lights on John, going for it.
Yep.
And then after that was the Dark Eternal Night opening for the Images and Words tour, and again lights on John doing the thing. So I agree with you.
And when I saw them play on the Distance Over Time tour, they opened up with Untethered Angel. Again, perfect opening for the tour. You know, open with the opening track. That's kind of what they do, right?
I was going to say, that's what they've done for eons. You know, they've always...
Well, it's certainly what they've done since Mike Portnoy quit the band, right? It's what they've done since he left, right? Because they always used to change it up a little bit. They used to change it up on tour, doing different sets, right? Now they don't do that so much. It's kind of like, here's your set and here's the tour.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, from what I understand, they always used to open with pretty much the same song every night, and then they change sort of everything in the middle around and swap out songs and all that kind of stuff.
Changing up the encores.
Yeah, stuff like that. But look, overall, The Alien, it's the lead single. You know, it's a fantastic way to open the album, and it's also a fantastic way to open a tour as well, or a show. It hits you pretty hard from the beginning to end, and it kind of sets up the album as well for the tone of the album, but not in the way that you might think, and I'll get back to this a little bit later on. However, I don't think this is going to have the biggest live appeal on the actual...
You don't think so? Why not?
I don't. I think it will have a massive amount of live appeal in the idea of people just champing at the bit and, you know, oh, I want to see it, and the lights go down, and everyone's like, ah! And then, you know, it all starts and all that kind of stuff. Cool.
Considering that many people probably won't have seen a live concert in nearly 2 years at this point.
Exactly, yes. So there's a lot depending on
where you are
in
the world,
that.
Of course.
Yeah, of course. You know, but it is, I mean, definitely there will be a lot of, you know, incredible emotion behind that and seeing that. But I don't think it's going to be the best live one. And I'll get to my favorite one that I think is going to be the best live a little bit later on.
I was going to say, there's a couple more pieces about this song that I wanted to get to. Mm-hmm. There's a nice little piano bit underneath that opening solo. I mean, you don't hear enough Dream Theater like piano on Dream Theater Records these days anymore. I mean, you know. And I was almost half expecting to hear John finish with that trill you always hear at the end of John Petrucci's solos, but no, he didn't go for that. And I was like, aha!
Well, that, well, you've done something different. Congratulations.
Yeah, I was going to say, he was setting it up for that bit, that, you know, the one we all know, right? Yep. It's, you know, it's like, it's sort of like Superman in Seinfeld. It's always there.
Yeah.
But not not in this song. Not in this song.
No,
And I like the groove at the end over the outro solo. That was really a really nice groove there, kind of galloping along sort of thing.
Absolutely. And I mean, that ending of it as well, just the way it finishes and you're like, yes, and you can see them then going straight from that into something else. Probably, honestly, straight into the second song of the album.
Probably.
Yeah. But there is a question here. You mentioned that there was the groove over the end of that solo there. There was a question from Richard Renu. How has Mike's drumming changed or evolved since the last record, and what's the overall production quality? You wanna start this one?
Yeah, I mean, with the drumming, or even, I'm going to expand it slightly, and just with like the writing on the record. I mean, he's definitely getting more bolder with the writing, adding more, coming up with more stuff. I mean, this drum groove, we explained it on the last episode, on the previous episode, we were talking about this song, was that the drum groove was something that he had and he brought into the band and was like, what about this? I mean, we all know that, like, the first record he was on, the drums were pretty much pre-written for him, right? We know this, you know, John wrote the drums and then he kind of played and added a little bit of spice or whatever.
Yep.
The second record, the self-titled record that he was on, you know, not much there, probably still a bit of, like, the new boy in the band sort of thing. You know, the Astonishing, I mean, I don't even know how much of that was pre-written or what sort of parts were created for him, whatever. Like, John and Jordan pretty much wrote that entire record themselves.
Yeah.
Don't know. On the Velocity record, you know, he came in with the riff for Paralyzed. He wrote the lyrics on Room 137. Mm. And this record, there's even more. You know, the opening section to this song. As of this taping, we still don't have in front of us, like, who wrote what song. Maybe he had a lyric on this song, on this record as well. Don't know.
Yeah, I'm not
sure. So I think
I'm
they're getting
sure.
back to a stage where all five members are contributing to the band again.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, everyone's contributing riffs and lyrics and melodies and all this sort of stuff. You know, up until this record, it was probably still a little bit, you know, John, Jordan, John and James.
Yeah.
In that order, descending order. But now I think it's probably more and more equal contribution from all five now, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the question that Richard asked there was, how has Mike's drumming changed or evolved since the last record? Honestly, you'd have to ask him directly, I think. I'm not a drummer myself, so I can't pick out the nuances. To me, it just kind of sounds like he's doing the Mike Mangini thing, where he's just a monster of a drummer.
But I think the question is framed, possibly, and I don't want to read too much into Rich's intentions here, but would we even expect too much change or evolution from Mike Mangini, right? You go back to the audition process for the thing that they did 10 years ago, right? He was essentially hired for the band to become a member of the band because he wasn't changing too much. You look at some of the comments that were made. You think about the way that, you know, Virgil Donati or Thomas Lang or were reinterpreting the songs, and you could see in some of the comments that were made, there was a definite pushback from that. It was like, no, we don't want that.
Yeah.
We don't want too much reinterpretation changing of the thing, right? So I dare say that if that was the remit that he was hired on, then that is probably what's going to go forward, right? He's there to kind of fit the sound and not try and change too much.
Yeah.
I'll get into my own personal theories about change and progressiveness later on in this bit, because I don't want to get derailed too much early on.
Not yet, anyway. You know, the overall production quality, may as well get this one out of the way early. The drum sound on the last few albums for me, with the exception of the Velocity album, has been a bit lackluster. Pearl drums, I'm not a massive fan of them. I like them as a company. I don't really like the drums themselves. They sound big and billowy and, you know, boomy. They don't have that snap to them that I think a lot of Dream Theater fans really loved, particularly about, you know, Portnoy and the way he played. But Portnoy's sound behind the kit was very much because of the equipment that he used as well as his playing. So I think a lot of Dream Theater fans are looking for that crack of the snare that you used to get with Portnoy, you know, that real high shrill crack, and the cymbals that don't sound like bits of tin hitting next to each other, because, you know, they use different cymbal companies. Mangini uses Zildjian, whereas Portnoy uses Sabian. And I'm not going to turn this into a Portnoy versus Mangini argument at all. I'm just looking at it objectively and looking at the sounds.
At some point, we are going to have to go on record with this in our theories on that. We might save that for later.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yep. No, I agree with you. At some point, we will have to go on record about that. I don't know. It seems like this album, the actual drum sound of the production of the album and so on and so forth, don't get me wrong, it's top-notch, it's world-class. But I think it's missing a little bit of that airiness, that openness that a lot of the earlier Dream Theater albums actually had. And I think that's partly because it's almost like a big wall of sound now, as opposed to like being able to hear the little awesome bits coming up in the background and everything like that. And, you know, sitting down with pair of cans, you could do that.
I think that's a trend in production right now. And
yes,
I'm going to blame
I'm
going to blame the only person that I can figure to blame for this, and that's Stephen Wilson, right? I don't know if he started this trend, but he's certainly the biggest purveyor of it in the prog world, right?
Yeah.
This super high fidelity, everything is there and it's crisp and it's done. I'm not a production guy and I'm not even a musician, so I don't know the whole technical terms here, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you understand the thing I'm going for here, right?
Yeah, no, I understand exactly what you're talking about. I think it's also a symptom of the loudness wars as well.
Potentially, or even like a rejection to the loudness wars, because everything's so loud, but everything's so crisp and tightly defined, right?
Mm.
And I think that I don't know if they've paid that much attention to it or they're that knowledgeable, but I sent that this is a bit of a reaction to that. It's like, no, we're not going for that. We're not doing that kind of record.
Yeah.
You know, but they're not into that super defined, crisp kind of thing. Whether that's a conscious choice or it probably is a conscious choice, but it's a more of a style, you know, that style of thing. That's kind of the Dream Theater sound.
Yeah.
You know, I can't imagine, like, maybe in 15 years' time or something, when they all stop making music or whatever and they decide to remaster the whole back catalogue and they get Stephen Wilson in, maybe then the fans will get that kind of record that they want. I don't know.
But
can you imagine Stephen Wilson trying to produce a Dream Theater record? I don't think he'd do it.
I think there'd be explosions in heads.
I'm not saying produce a record now, because I don't think he'd do it. Right? They're not into that. But I'm saying going back and doing the remastering stuff. I don't think, I get the distinct impression, and maybe someone can correct me on this if they've seen an interview or whatever, I get the distinct impression that Stephen Wilson's not exactly the biggest Dream Theater fan.
I get the distinct impression that Stephen Wilson is not the biggest anything fan that doesn't fit his, like, little box.
Aside from Scott Walker, that's probably true.
No, we're not going. We are not going on the Scott Walker train again. we're moving on to the next song here, Answering the Call. What do you think?
I mean, I like the darker groove at the start. Without having heard, when I first listened to this record, I knew there was an 8-string on this record, right?
Mm, mm-hmm.
And I thought this song was the 8-string, but it's not. And you had that confirmed by John in that interview that you did.
Yep.
Earlier in the week. So, I mean, but the thing is, a nice groove at the start, and then breaks cover into another melodic solo out of the intro again. The contrast between the two is cool, but it's kind of like, you did that on the previous song, and now you're doing it again.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, if you think this melodic solo thing isn't going to show up on this record later on, you're dead wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I was really worried when I first heard it, because it sounded like Nickelback's Feed the Machine. And I was like, ah, shit, either Nickelback got it really right for a track or DT stooped to that level. Now, I was actually having a conversation with some friends of mine the other day about how it's fun to hate Nickelback and how Nickelback are actually quite good musicians. And I still do think that. So it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek what I said there about DT stooping to their level.
The Nickelback thing is mostly just like A, snobbery, and B, well, they've bought it, like, I don't think even, like, Chad Kroeger was quoted this as an interview. It's like, well, we've sold a bunch of records, so somebody must like it, right?
100%. Yeah.
I don't know if it's him that said it, but I remember reading a quote about Nickelback somewhere. It was like, well, they've sold however many million records, right? So somebody must like the record, right?
100%. Look, of the two, frankly, I think, I think Nickelback probably got it really right, and this is just a coincidence. You know, I mean, it's definitely a lot straighter than the previous track. Seems to be mostly in 4/4 and has all those DT elements. So, you know, you've got soaring choruses, sing-along moments, shred-fest solos, keyboard wizardry, and just altogether Dream Theater things, which make it a really good track. There's even a unison section as well in the solo, and that gent chuggy bit is pretty interesting, and it's always good to hear them do a headbangy kind of moment, and it's an awesome way to end the track. You know, dead stops aren't my favorite things, but when they're done extremely well, they're awesome.
Did they start that? Like, is that a thing that they started?
The stop dead? Don't think so. I don't think so. I mean, arguably, it was probably the Beatles that went halfway through a track.
I Want You She's So Heavy, and then like yeah. on when Dream Theater Pull Me Under, they kind of echoed back to that on the other one. Yeah, okay, fair. They didn't start it, but they've definitely used it a couple of times.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the big middle section solo brings back memories of the ending of The Dark Eternal Night. You know, big seven string riff into a solo section. That's, you know, reminiscent of something out of Systematic Chaos or maybe Black Cloud's Silver Linings era. Solo section's pretty typical. It's John and Jordan trading solos. There's a unison section, as I mentioned. And then big octobans, you know, to close it out, and then back into the chorus. Interesting lyrics as well. You've got some stuff written here for the lyrics as well, Hoggy.
Yeah, so, like, there was a couple of little lyrics there. It was like, when will the long-held truths be cast aside? Embrace our fellow man, no longer vilified. And decisions by which to act, programmed, no turning back, a call upon a switch turned on. You know, when will long-held truths be cast aside? Is this that sort of... Yeah, they've written about a couple of these sort of things before, that sort of conflict between, I don't know, spirituality, religion, whatever you want to call it, and science. You know, that sort of thing. I wonder if that's part of it.
I think it is. Yeah. I mean, it's certainly, with the rest of the lyrics in the song, it seems to be that kind of, you know, fight or flight is threatening, hidden thoughts are deafening, your guilt feeding the flame. You know, and it's that
your guilt feeding the flame. If I had to come up with, like, I don't know, like John sort of danced around it in the interview a little bit, where he was sort of like, oh, would, you know, once the pandemic hit and the tour's off, rah rah rah, right? They sort of were like, well, let's get back in the studio. So like, I don't think they had the idea to just sort of sit and kind of just sort of sit down for a bit. They were like, no, literally, you know, let's keep going forward, sort of thing.
Yeah,
I don't know if it's a guilt thing. I don't know.
I mean, the thing, like, if you handed those lyrics to me and just said, what do you reckon this is about? I would have to say, you know, the political and social-political divide that's in the United States at the moment. You know, it's no secret that Petrucci is a Republican. I don't know what the other guys...
Is he a Republican, though? I know he's talked about being, like, a Catholic, but is he a Republican?
Trump. I think he made it reasonably clear in an interview that he was a supporter of Trump.
Really?
Yeah.
Ugh, gross.
So, you know, or, you know, if he's not, then that's what I remember the interview being. But, you know, it could be that divide because, you know, here in Australia, you can be Labor and Liberal and all that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, you'll go to the pub and you'll all have a beer, right? And that seems to be, unfortunately, that's collapsing here in Australia. That mateship kind of thing is degrading. But there is
okay.
Just a quick bit of real time follow up here.
I mean, I found the quote.
Yep.
You know, it wasn't exactly an endorsement of Trump, but he was going to quote. He was quoted as like to give him a chance.
Yes.
So I think it was, you know, that sort of a tempering. There was a lot of that around at the time, right? There were loads
absolutely.
Of people who were like, well, he hasn't actually been president yet. You know, who knows? Maybe he'll actually do a good job.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert: he didn't.
Yeah. But yeah, so I mean, it could be a lament at the fact that things are becoming so divided, and you know, there's these ideas of these long held truths. It's like, oh, why do you do it that way? Because that's just the way it's done. But that's just a stupid fucking idea, right? So you know, they'll cast that away, that kind of stuff. I mean, that's kind of what I get from that. There have been other reviewers who've said that this track has like a memorable riff in it, in the likes of like the idea of it being a memorable as things like the riff from Panic Attack and Yitzhi Jam. That's complete and utter horseshit. It's a great track, but I'm not super... It's not one of those riffs where you go, yeah, like, remember that riff from that, you know, answering the call? It's like, no. But everyone remembers The Dark Eternal Night. Everyone remembers Panic Attack. You know, there's those songs that are just gold at that time.
If I was going to pin a super memorable riff onto this, I would probably end up picking The Alien. Like, that opening bit, I think, is really cool and, you know, rather memorable.
Yeah.
The rest of this record, I don't think there's anything in there that's super, super memorable that sort of gives you that, for lack of a better term, to quote James May, gives you the fizz, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah,
if you don't know what I'm talking about, go and Google it. I'm not explaining it here.
Yeah, no, it's. I really like this track. Let's go on to the next one, and then I'll start bringing in some of my concerns.
Yes. So the next song, Invisible Monster. Now, we sort of danced around this one a little bit. I'm gonna bring it up here now. I mean, we talked about it. It was like the creative process. And when you think about it, not the first time John Petrucci has written about the creative process. It's coming at it from a different angle. Maybe he feels it differently now than when he first wrote Wither, you know, about the problems with the blank page. Yeah. Or, you know, something like As I Am or Misunderstood, where he's like feeling like he has to live up to others' expectations of him as a player.
Yeah.
But there's the opening couple of stanzas here. It's like, when you face the creature that waits beneath your bed, will you stare into its eyes or look away? Running towards the fire or fleeing from the frame, the choice to seek or hide is yours to make.
Yeah.
So again, it's about engaging that creative process. And, it's a difficult thing. I mean, from my own very limited understanding of, like, the creative thing, I'm not an arts guy, I don't work in the arts or the media space, but it's that same sort of thing. It's like, well, you just got to, like, engage the thing and get past that initial discomfort or until you end up with something, okay, now I've got something to work with here.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I want to talk about... There's a section in that particular the opening lyrics, you know, when you face a creature that waits beneath your bed, will you stare into its eyes or look away? I want to talk about the major resolution in that track on the opening lyric, you know, that they modulate or they resolve to the major on that. And it is fucking gorgeous. It is really, really nice. And it was a surprise when I first heard it, because I've only heard it in one other place before, which is in a song called Motley Crue by a guy called Tomston. And it just takes it to a completely different area. You know, I love that kind of stuff. I just wish there were a few more risks like that in this track. You know, otherwise it's a pretty safe track to put out, particularly as a single. It delves into some darker lyrics, something which we've noticed, especially in the last sort of 6-12 months with the pandemic. There's been a lot of people talking and putting out music with a little bit darker and so on and so forth with these dark times that we're on at the moment. You know, there's also some serious DT roots in here, you know, chuggy and rock moments, not super metal either, but, you know, definitely dark. The content is darker as well. But the chorus felt a little flat. I don't know if you got the same thing.
Yeah, there was just something, there's not something there. Again, it's the sort of thing that doesn't give you the fizz, as it were. It's kind of missing there a little bit, I don't know.
There were plenty of Petrucci movements in, moments, in this one as well. You know, stuff that made me fall in love with the way he plays, or sort of a harken back to it, you know, not shred fest, not, you know, sort of stuff. That's just shit. Just leaves me cold. Right. You know, it's technical, but not over the top. You know, the solo though is straight up out of Systematic Chaos, which is awesome. I love that album. But then there's a short unison solo section, and then it goes back into a little bit of this, and then back into the chorus, and now I'm starting to sense a serious theme.
Yeah. This Every is where I... Yeah.
Single song is the same. It's like they just had a whiteboard that went, this is how you construct song, and they did that.
Yeah, it's sort of almost like... Like, it was sort of like a Markov chain, right?
Yeah.
Okay, we've done that. We've done the first verse. We've got the chorus. We've got the interlude bit. Then we've got the second verse, which we're going to change the key, and we're going to do something there.
Yeah.
And we've got the chorus, and then we've got, like, the middle section, which is just a little bit longer than it probably needs to be. Okay, yep. I get it. Like, the distance over time stuff, they were like, okay, it was a bit like Octavarium, right? We're targeting the shorter, more concise kind of movements here.
Yeah.
We're not too much flab. We're going to do all their little things. They're technically very interesting, but we're going to keep moving forward.
Mm.
This record doesn't have that so much. I don't know if that's a conscious reaction to the previous record or whether I'm not sure, but I don't think it works.
See, I remember saying with Distance Over Time that there were tracks, for example, like Barstool Warrior, right? I could listen to a 10-minute version of that because that's such a good song and it kind of ends sort of weird. And I remember saying at the time when we did the review, I want a longer version of this, right? I want to see what they would do if they take the brakes off and just go hell for leather. But I wanted a longer version of those songs, not these ones, you know. It's like this one's just the shortest track on the entire album is like 6.5 minutes or something like that. And it really doesn't. A lot of the other ones don't need to be 9 minutes, 10 minutes, 8 minutes. There's quite a lot of flab in there that could easily be cut out. And this is the part where we come to the first controversial, really controversial opinion of this show.
Ooh, here we go. Hot takes from Dave. Here we go.
These guys need a fucking producer.
I think at this point, yeah, I think they do.
And you know who, like, I think they should bring in to produce? It's never going to fucking happen, but I'll tell you who they should bring in to produce the next album. Portnoy.
Nah, not a thousand years.
I'm not saying that it would happen. I'm not saying that it
wouldn't happen,
but
it wouldn't happen
if there was
not when you've got one member of the band who's been on record in several places saying he hasn't spoken a word to Mike Portnoy in 10 years.
No, I completely understand that, and I'm not suggesting that it would ever happen. But if there's any chance to rein this in, he's probably the best shot of it. But it's alarmingly apparent that these guys need a producer now.
Here's the problem: I don't think he is. Right? I don't think he is. Because the back end of the Roadrunner era was probably when they were the most guilty of this. Of just, like, ridiculous extended sections for no good reason.
Yeah, but at least,
like,
it was still engaging.
Systematic Chaos and Black... Yeah, but Systematic Clouds and Black Chaos, it's basically the same thing. It's just, like, these elongated sections for no good reason.
Sure, I understand that. But there was...
I don't think he's the guy that will be the like, if I was going to say a producer to kind of tighten things up and keep it moving forward, the one I would pick would be, like, either Stephen Wilson or Nick Raskolnikov, who did the last couple of Rush records.
Yeah, maybe. Like, yeah.
I think he was that guy that could sort of keep things moving. And I think he would probably get it. Like, he would understand the need for complexity, having done those records with Rush, right? The thought process of creating records towards the end there is pretty much the same as what it is for Dream Theater, you know, like doing interesting, complicated bits, but trying to sort of keep it moving forward in a song form rather than just turning it into a shred fest, right? So I think he'd be the guy. I mean, that would also then call into question all sorts of production qualities that diehard Rush fans like to dunk on Nick for. You think, you know, they think the records are produced really badly, which I think is complete bullshit, but whatever.
Yeah. But I don't know. It's just, there seems to be at this point now where... They're at this point now where they're making music, and it's good music. It's technical. It's everything you want a Dream Theater album to be. But that's kind of the problem as well, right?
Yeah.
Look, I really like this track.
But
right?
Here's the problem,
this,
right?
This particular one answering the call.
I can just to follow on from that slightly. I think the problem is when they did try to do something really different, right? They tried to do something really different with The Astonishing, and everybody bloody hated it.
Yeah, I mean,
I think that's part of the problem. I think the reaction to that record is probably going to shape the next few, where it's like, no, we tried something different, everybody hated it.
We could talk about the
botched marketing campaign and the fact that we all waited 6 months to get our records, and, you know, us within the Dream Theater fan community, they basically stopped talking to us and all the rest of it, right? We can wax lyrical about that all day long.
I mean, you can talk about that. You can also talk about the fact that everyone who went and saw the live show got it.
Yeah.
Right? And we are at a disadvantage where we didn't get to see the live show. We didn't get to actually see all the bits in between. And as I said at the time when I reviewed, when I actually reviewed it, that was back in the AU days, you know, I said that it felt like you were listening to the songs from a musical, but you didn't have all the stage play behind it to actually understand what the fuck was going on.
Totally, 100%. The Astonishing has the same problem that Berylligan's Brave does, right?
Yes,
until you actually see the record performed live, it's like, ah, right, okay, now I get it. Now I get the story. Mm-hmm. Now I understand what they're trying to go with here.
Yeah.
Okay, probably not as complicated a storyline as what Brave was, but same problem. Like, same problem.
Yeah. I mean, it's... Anyway, before we lose all this to waxing lyrical about all of that, Answering the Call. Look, overall, I like the track. I mean, it has everything I like about Dream Theater in the track, right? So there's nothing actually to not like. Moving on, though, Sleeping Giant. Very interesting intro.
Yeah, we have straight Mellotron in the intro, which I can't think. Maybe I think on Misunderstood, I think, was the last time I heard Mellotron on a Dream Theater record.
Mm-hmm.
I think, unless there's something else I'm thinking. No, I think that's it. Mm-hmm. So it's like, I know he's got a Mellotron. I know he uses one from time to time on other things. But it's the first time I heard Mellotron in the intro. Now, the first verse of this song, when I was listening to it, reminded me of a couple of different Rush songs.
Mm-hmm.
Most notably, the ones on the Test for Echo record. The one I'm going to draw a comparison to for the purposes of the podcast is a song called Half the World.
Mm-hmm.
I'll start with the lyrics for Sleeping Giant. It's, some will be driven by conflict, others will fight the good fight. Some will rely on darkness, some will rely on the light.
Mm.
Some elevate with compassion, yearning for knowledge and peace. Some motivate through aggression, selfishly serving their own needs. Now let's cut to back to 1996 when Rush put out this Test for Echo record. And I'm going to read the first verse to Half the World.
Mm-hmm.
See if you can spot a pattern here. Half the world hates what half the world does every day. Half the world waits while half the world gets on with it anyway. Half the world lives, half the world makes, half the world gives while the other half takes.
Mm-hmm.
You see a pattern there.
I can indeed. I suppose the question now, is, did they influence those lyrics? Or is it like, you know, has the human race just not changed for the last 30 years? You know what I mean?
I mean, that's definitely possible. I mean, and also as well, like, I can hear many Dream Theater fans groaning in the background. Like, oh, yeah, here we go. Hot take, Hoggy. You know, Dream Theater influenced by Rush. Ha, ha, ha. And it's like, yeah, maybe this is like a little doff of the hat to Rush in a way.
Yeah.
Because there's plenty of those across a whole lot of Dream Theater records.
Mm.
If you want to hear somehow how some of that goes down, I'm going to put a link in the episodes to another podcast called Radical Research, where they did an entire episode of this.
Mm-hmm.
Not exclusively Dream Theater, although they acknowledge that they probably could have done a whole episode about Dream Theater influenced by Rush.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll put a link to that episode. You can go and listen to that whole dichotomy over there.
Mm-hmm.
So, so we get the lyrics, right? There's a little bit of an influence there from some Rush songs, right? And the other one that it reminds me of as well is Resist, but I'm not going to read that out because it'll take too long.
Yep.
So the middle section in this second verse is interesting. Is that like an Ebo guitar sound or is that a keyboard thing?
Look, it could be either. I think it's more a keyboard thing. I think it's more a keyboard thing, frankly. But it might be both. I mean, it could be an Ebo thing. You know, things are getting so technical and so good these days. Who knows what's playing what?
It could be. Yeah, you're right. You're probably right. There probably is a keyboard thing. But again, once we get into the extended solo section in the middle of the song, I feel it drags on a bit too much.
Yep.
Okay. Yes, they experimented a bit with the shorter, more direct sound on Distance Over Time, and I was like, great, they're moving with the times. They're drawing influences from their contemporaries in that area where they're doing that sort of stuff. And then we get to this record, and this just sounds like something from the Roadrunner era of Dream Theater.
Mm.
I mean, I know I just finished complaining about that section, but I had to bring it up again.
Yeah, no, I mean, for me, this track had a really interesting start. Pretty sure it's almost the exact same key and so on and so forth at the start of the Enigma Machine back on Dream Theater, I think. Some really interesting time signatures. Polyrhythms everywhere. You know, just when you think you're in 12-8, you're suddenly not, and there's, you know, a whole bunch of crazy shit going on. I mean, Mangini is a monster. He can play that stuff with one hand tied behind his back. Very, very, very good. That riff is an absolute head-banging riff for sure, too. I mean, I can see you know, people doing the headbanging to it live, and, you know, the people that stand there with their crossed arms crossed, even with that, you know, as I fondly refer to it, the day after curry face, you know, on just, you know,
I wondered when that reference was going to turn up in this episode. People, if you had that on your bingo cards, mark it off.
You know, the main body of the song, it's very melodic dream theater. You know, there's a lot of systematic chaos. There's a lot of scenes in there. The keyboard part playing underneath the main riff is almost straight out of These Walls from Octavarium as well. Like, it's got that same similar vibe to it. It's all in here. The entire playbook. It's a great song. There's even the ragtime thing.
Oh, yes, the ragtime thing. Yes, that needs to make an appearance again from time to time on records.
Absolutely. You know, there's that the shadows disappear at night, that serious sing-along chorus. And this, I think, is probably going to be the best live track. Because the way that the actual album the song flows, you can see, it's one of those, one of the things I loved about Dream Theater when I first got into them was listening to, you know, like Endless Sacrifice and getting to the end of that solo section and going, hang on, how the fuck did we get here? And then you go back and you listen to the bit. That's what I did with this track. I was like, okay, hang on, how do we get here? Like, this is awesome. And you can see where they set things up and then they bring them back to change the part and so on and so forth. I think a lot of the other tracks on this album just do that whole, you know, we're just going to change something here because we can, as opposed to setting it up and then having that payoff and it changes and so on and so forth. And that's sadly missing in a lot of those tracks on this one.
Yeah, agreed.
But once again, this track starts off with an interesting riff, goes into a couple of verses, then it goes into a solo section. There's solo trades between Jordan and John. They do their thing. They bring in choirs for the final part of the middle section, then boom, back into a sing-along chorus. Like, the formula hasn't changed. I mean, this is probably the best track on the album, to be fair. But this is what I meant by the alien was setting the album up, right? It set the whole formula. Every fucking song looks the same. And at this point, I'm going, this is not an album. This is a collection of singles.
Yeah. I mean, there was a question earlier on from Stephen James about, are the first two singles a good indication of the album overall, or are there a few surprises in store? Interesting how you compare it to Distance Over Time. I mean, I feel like we have to bring this question up now. I had saved this for our sort of summary section.
Sure.
But, like, it's a really good question, and Stephen has absolutely nailed this out of the park.
Yeah.
Like, I'm pretty sure you and I, Dave, both really liked the Velocity record. We thought that was a really, really good record.
Fantastic.
After the disappointment of The Astonishing, where we just, you know, we still can't really get behind that record for all the reasons we've discussed ad nauseum on this podcast already.
Yep.
Distance Over Time was a real return to form, you know, concise, direct, and quintessentially Dream Theater.
Mm. And this, as I one, said, like, you know, there were tracks on that one where I wanted them to be longer. I wanted to see what they were going to do with, for example, Bastard Warrior. You know, it felt like it ended too soon. And I was like, okay, so that's what they were doing. So that's what I was hoping this album was going to be.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the problem with this thing. It's like, you know, I mean, this one just doesn't feel as tight.
No.
I mean, it feels, and I'm sure the band will deny this to high heaven, but it feels rushed. But I have a theory.
Mm-hmm.
Here's my theory. I kind of feel like there was maybe a little bit of pressure to get, like, come on, can you finish the record so we can get it out, because the things are starting to happen in the tour, like the tours are starting to get booked now. So I kind of feel like there may have been a little bit of, maybe not explicitly, someone from the record label coming down saying, hey, you finish the damn record, but there might have been just a little bit of a push to try and get it done, to get it out for this next tour cycle that's starting to open up, right?
Maybe. I mean,
and I'd like, the band are so tight-lipped about internal sort of pressures from record labels and things, they make it sound like it's all hunky-dunky, and maybe it actually is. But I get the distinct impression this was just a little bit rushed.
Yeah, I kind of get that same impression as well, but it's interesting because I actually asked John Myung about that in the interview. And I was like, look, how did that change the album? Because, you know, normally you your normal idea is, you know, write, record, tour, and you kind of didn't get to do the tour part. So, you know, how did that influence the album? How did it influence when it was released? And he said, look, didn't really all that much. It would, the album probably would have come out, you know, a month or two later, like, you know. Yeah. So, but I suppose because they didn't have the global tour experience, you know, they didn't get to go into Asia and into Japan and all that and into Australia and see some of the stuff that's going on in those areas. So they wouldn't have had those influences. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, we're four tracks in and we've been served up four songs that are kind of the same. I mean, yeah, they're not the same song, but they're the same style, and they're the same, it's the same progression through the whole thing.
This is what I was saying, that, like, at a certain point in, like, the band's career now, should we expect anything different? Like, I don't think so.
Well,
like, they tried to be different, they tried to do something long form that was kind of out of the box, and the fans weren't interested. This was going to be an after-show topic, but I'm just going to roll with it anyway. I genuinely don't think that, like, maybe it's a perception thing. Maybe the fans really do want to hear that. And if you really want to hear something, like, different and out of the box, different from the band, and if you are one of those fans, please get in touch. I'd love to hear from you. Absolutely. But I get the distinct impression that from the band, at least, from all the things they've said and all the interviews that they've done and the process for hiring a new drummer, is that they understand that their fans don't want anything different. That they've got the sound, the fans like the sound, and they're just going to keep pumping the records out like that, in that style, in that vein. And at a certain point, you start to ask the question, is it really that progressive anymore if you know what's coming?
That's
like the finer details and the intricacies of what they actually play will be different from time to time, but if the formula is baked in, what's the difference?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Like, and for the record, like, I know we're only halfway through the reward and through the review here, and it might sound like we're dunking on this record pretty hard. I'm actually not. I still think this is actually a relatively good Dream Theater record.
Yeah.
But I just start to wonder, it's like we're caught in that dichotomy between what the band want to do and what I'd like to hear. And I went through this with Stephen Wilson, right?
Mm.
My wife did as well, just one record further earlier than I did. It was like, okay, Stephen Wilson is definitely chasing, like, the pop thing now, right? Yep. I couldn't give two figs what he does in the pop realm because I don't think it's not what I'm listening for. It's not what I'm listening to music for. I'm not interested in that style of music. That's the style of music he wants to play, and I'm sure many fans would enjoy it and go along with it. Great, fantastic. Like, part of me, in some deep part of Stephen Wilson's brain, reckons that maybe he did the Future Bites just to piss off all the caked-on old prog fans who wanted to be the new Pink Floyd. I kind of feel like he did that just to piss them off, which if he actually did would be amazing, because that was it's a fantastic, like, rip on his entire fan base who keep hailing him as, like, the king of prog. Right? But here's the thing. I don't think Dream Theater are in that same position. They're not interested in going down that road just to make a record. They like the music that they make, and they know that the fans like them. That there's a good core of that fan base that like the music that they make too. So where's the problem?
Yeah,
they don't necessarily have that drive to constantly like a Marillion or a Stephen Wilson or any number of these other bands, right? Constantly looking to reinvent. How do I change or adapt what's happening? Right?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I don't know. I mean, before we get bogged down in any of that, we should get through the rest of the album, I think.
Yeah, I've kind of tipped my hand already doing a review, doing the summary halfway through the record, but yeah. I just wanted to get that on record. That, like, it might sound like I'm dunking on this record, but I'm really not.
Transcending Time.
And now what that I've just said all that, my notes for the intro of this are, the intro sounds way too much like Surrender to Reason for my liking. Like, and if this song lyrically isn't about pandemics and lockdowns, then I'm a bad judge. I mean, drifting in a far-off place, I roam the countryside, seeking wings of thought, waiting in the blind. Enchanted and transfixed, I'm pulled into the still by a backward-ticking clock held against my will. Now, if that backwards-ticking clock held against my will thing doesn't sound like a metaphor for a lockdown, then I'm a bad judge. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, well, we all know that it's a, they're just sparkling stay-at-home orders in the USA.
oh, yeah. Well, actually, no, in New York, they had some pretty severe lockdowns. Like, they were proper full-on stay-at-home, stay-in-place orders, right?
Yeah,
it wasn't
well, that's,
like,
that's true, yeah.
They weren't in the South, they weren't in Florida, where it was kind of free and easy and, you know, don't need to wear masks and let's have fights in school board meetings about whether or not we want the kids to wear masks, right? We didn't have that. Sure, they read about it, but we didn't have that up in New York. At least not as far as I'm aware.
No. Yeah, I mean, I tend to agree with you. It's probably about pandemic and lockdowns. I don't know whether or not we'll ever get an answer
topic,
on that.
The topic is... I was going to say the topic is pretty much unavoidable. Like, you got to reference it at some point, unless you're making a very conscious decision. And I know Steve Hogarth has said this about the new Merle record coming out. He's like, they've made a very conscious decision not to write about the pandemic and not to write about the lockdown. But there's still, like, elements of it that creep into the lyrics around the way, right?
Oh, for sure. You wouldn't be able to, you know, do an album at the moment without talking about lockdowns and pandemics and all that kind of stuff. Like, you just can't get... It's been everyone's life for the last two fucking years. You know what I mean? You're not going to get away
from
it.
No, not at all.
You know, the track itself has got some serious early DT vibes to it. And I'm actually about this. No, there's no secrets here or showing hand here. This is my favorite track on the album. I don't think it's the best track on the album, but it is my favorite track. It's also the only track I found myself air guitaring to. Like, it was because it was beautiful and melodic, and the way it was done, it was very, it was something like falling, something reminiscent of like falling into infinity, right? And you know how much I love that album.
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
If I'm critical about it, I mean, I love the chorus, but did they have to do a key change for the sake of a fucking key change? Like, if it was played straighter, it would have been nice. You know, it feels like
But the thing is. The answer to that question from, like, do we need to do this for the sake of doing the thing? More often than not, like, in at least if they're harking back to the earlier days, the more often than not, the answer to that question was almost always yes.
No, I understand that. It just feels like this song was a really straight song that got progged up just because they could. You know what I mean? Instead of just going, no, hang on, we've actually got a really good track here, let's leave it the fuck alone.
Ah, I see. This is the I remember Genesis talking about this when they wrote. I think it was Invisible Touch. Mm-hmm. It was like one of the first times they had a good good riff and a good beat and all the rest of it, and then they didn't touch it.
Yeah.
Just were like, nah, we've got it. Good hit. Let's just move forward on that.
Yeah, one of the biggest hits of the 80s. Thank God they didn't touch it.
Totally. Yeah.
You know.
And it's pretty much like that was almost like the high point of their cementing their change from prog band to pop band.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, the track itself feels like it could have almost been on a LaBrie solo album. And maybe that's kind of why I liked it, because I actually really liked LaBrie solo stuff. But then the middle section kicks in, and we're in Petrucci Shredfest territory, which is cool, but it's not the good part of the track. But it didn't need to be there. They could have cut that entire part out and just gone straight to the piano and acoustic guitar bit, done a gorgeous solo over that, and then straight into the ending, right? But yet again, we have intro, singy bit, shreddy fest, other bits, straight into the end and out. You know what I mean? It's very formulaic. This song was a little bit too long, frankly, but I loved the outro. That piano outro was just, oh, chef's kiss, mwah. Like, I absolutely loved that. And that was, like, one of the surprising moments on this album, right? It was a part where I was like, okay, that's actually a really cool way to get through, to end a track. It was beautiful. Really reminded me of About to Crash, the reprise of that. And that the beautiful guitar line melody that they... Like, that was really cool. And it was very old school Dream Theater. You know, that's the side of Petrucci I love, is that simple playing exactly what it needs to be played, instead of how many notes can I fit into 4 seconds, you know what I mean?
That's probably like a symptom of the evolution of John's guitar playing. Like before, you know, early 90s, that sort of era, right? They sort of felt the need to see if they can try and cram as many notes and, you know, how many words can we chuck in this lyric and how can we da-da-da-da, right? That. And then eventually they sort of mellowed out a little bit or whatever, and then they just feel like that we don't need to do that.
Yeah.
We've got the confidence to play this part, which is cool and still interesting, but doesn't need to be like this technical, complicated treadfest sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah, and I actually really like that stuff when there's stuff that's it's woody, it's open, it's warm, it's nice, it serves the track and it serves the whole thing. It's just well composed. And that's what I love about this track. This track I've listened to more than any of the other tracks. Like, I go back and listen to it, and I just enjoy it. And I would really love to see it live, because I think it's...
Hopefully we do get it live.
Well, let's hope. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you know, the thing is as well, I mean, if they do the evening with tours, there's only 7 songs on this record, right?
Mm-hmm.
Should be able to get all of them in there.
Should.
If they do the evening with, they do the full 3-hour bit, right? They should be able to get all 7 songs in there. You'd hope.
You'd hope so. You'd hope so.
Because the record itself is only, what, 50-something minutes long?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, so they could get it in there. Mm. You play for 2.5 hours, you play the whole record, right? You've got 1.5 hours to kind of do other things.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
You probably won't need to do too many other long, like really, really long songs. You don't need to do the other epics because they've already got this one on the record, so you probably won't need to do too many more of those.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I could see this album being intertwined with stuff from 6 Degrees, and maybe some stuff from Octavarium as well.
Well, like, here's the fun part with this record. I don't, because it doesn't, you know, without having to bang this whole drum again, because it doesn't stand apart too much from the other records in the Dream Theater catalog in terms of stylistically, right? It's not, like, I think you'd find it pretty hard to shoehorn bits of The Astonishing into their shows now, right? True. It wouldn't work.
Mm.
Right, unless you tried to reorchestrate it acoustically or something and do it with strings or whatever, which would be interesting to hear. But I don't think you could. You probably wouldn't be able to do that. But all the other records, like, you could pretty well put one of these songs against something from the Awake album, and it wouldn't sound too jarring. You could probably put this stuff against something from from 6 Degrees of Inner, and it probably wouldn't be too bad. It'd be probably work pretty well in terms of like flow and whatever, right?
Yeah, agreed.
The one thing this record doesn't really have is a ballad. Like, there's no ballad here.
Yeah, the most ballady of them is Transcending Time.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Pretty much. But you don't have, like, Along for the Ride. You don't have Wait for Sleep or even Lifting Shadows or, you know, one of the... Or even, you know, the most ballady of the ballad albums of all was, like, Falling to Infinity, which had 3 of them on there.
Yeah.
So,
fantastic album.
Yeah.
Don't care what anyone says. Fight me.
Yeah, you don't. So that's the one thing that isn't on this record, which if you chucked a ballad on there, would it add anything? No, probably not.
Probably not. No.
And then you start to run into like vinyl length problems, which is always a thing that people need to consider.
Yeah, again. Anyway.
Anyway. Let's move on. So, Awaken the Master. Now, we heard you talk about this song specifically with John, because this is the John Myung lyric on this album, and he spoke about the human spirit not being able to keep up with the pace of technology, referencing a documentary, Inner World, Outer Worlds, which I'm going to have to check out now. It sounds interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, this sort of touches on themes that he discussed in S2N, which we checked that off as like, oh yeah, this is talking about like social media, right?
Yeah.
And even like, I mean, that song's not that old. And even now, you think about how the social media world has changed and, you know, I don't think TikTok was a thing 2 years ago. Now it is. So, you know, I think he's sort of referencing things that he's talked about there, but from a different perspective. Rather than just commenting on the phenomenon of the technology, which is what I think S2N was about, this is more after sort of ways to combat it or ways to think about it and work with the technology in a way. You know, he's talking about using your heart and your ears, you know, that sort of thing.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, now we get to the part that Dave has just been chomping at the bit all podcast to talk about.
Here from
Daniel Hardy, you know, the 8-string guitar tone and that song in general, is it any good? Wondering if it's all just low F sharp notes or if we can expect something more in line with the introduction of the 7-string songs on Awake. Now, before you jump in here, Dave, I'm no guitar player, but I didn't even pick that this was the 8-string song. It's only once you told me that it was. I thought Answering the Call was the 8-string song, but that's probably just the baritone or a 7-string or whatever, right? As for Daniel's question about the, quote, all low F-sharp notes, I mean, I'm not that great with relative pitch, But that riff in the verse sure sounds like a bunch of F-sharp notes chugged along.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, does it add being on an 8-string? No, I don't think it does. Now I'm just going to let you off the leash, Dave, so go for it.
Righto. Okay. Let me just hang up. Righto. Crack my knuckles there. No, but my first reaction when I first heard the first note of it, I was like, oh, 8-string, boy, here we go, you know. And then about 10 seconds later, I was like, this doesn't need to be on an 8-string. What is this? It's a huge intro, and yeah, okay, so we now know John has an 8-string and can play one, like we ever doubted that he could. But it was wasted. I mean, seriously, it's a cool riff, but it would have sounded just at home on a 7-string or a 6, and probably would have opened up some more options to underpin it with something way more punchy. I mean, like 8 strings and an organ underneath it? Fucking what? You know, there's a section at a minute 20 where it goes into full prog mode and we get something really interesting with the 8-string, which is, yeah, kind of what we saw with the introduction of the 7-string stuff on Awake, Daniel, to answer your question. But then straight after that, you're straight off into a typical solo section underpinned by piano. The solo is absolutely gorgeous, and it shows off that side of Petrucci I've been speaking about quite a bit on this show, that melodic, beautiful side of him, then that interplay between what's there and what's not. And then you're straight into the main part of the song again, and it's 2.5 minutes of bloat that doesn't need to be there. It serves the song, kind of, but it doesn't serve the album. Again, it just feels like this album is just a collection of different Dream Theater singles. You know, the solo's cool, but it's there to have another solo, and then there's Into a Jordan solo, and da-da-da-da-da, we've heard all this before. The 8-string, in my opinion, was not required at all for this particular... Now, I'm not going to begrudge John and Music Man and all those guys for wanting to create an 8-string and seeing what he could do with it and all that kind of stuff, but considering that they almost finished the album, and then John came in with his new shiny toys, his 8-string, was like, hey, I want to write a song for this, and this was the result?
It almost sounds really like annoying. It sounds like an afterthought.
It sounds like an afterthought, and the thing that really pisses me off is that these are the best lyrics on the entire album. The lyrics are fucking fantastic. And can we just have John Myong write some more lyrics, please? Like, I mean, fuck. Like, he's like, the guy has got an incredible way with words. Like, and they're just, you know, you know, spinning through life lost in the spiral of time, turning the stone, circles of darkness and time, remember hereafter, awaken the master. Right? And it's the interplay between the lyrics and the actual... the heaviness, I suppose, and the darkness of the whole song is really, really, really interesting. And there's a part that hit me really hard, which was a part where it said, you made it to the top just to find out you're only halfway there, all along missing the point of the journey.
What a fantastic sentiment.
Holy shit. It's like all the other stuff in this entire album, you know, they're talking about this and, you know, writing and all that kind of stuff. And this is the one line that I went, that is fucking cool, and it is poignant, and I don't know. Like, I'm in such two minds about this song, because they could have done it on a 7-string. They could have done it on a 6. It didn't have to be a low kind of stuff. To go in a little bit more, Daniel, to your question as well, 8-string guitar tone... 8-strings suffer from a particular issue, which is that low note is just so fucking low. You really need to boost your mids and so on and so forth in your treble, but particularly your high mids, and scoop some of the others, scoop a lot of the lows out, so that you can actually hear clarity and definition in those notes. Petrucci's settings did not suit this at all, in my opinion. He can play whatever he wants, right? He could play a 9-string if he wants. He could play a... I'm pretty sure he could nail a pickup on a piece of wood and ring two wires between it, and he'd make it sound good. But the actual use of the 8-string was really underutilized. You know, I'm not suggesting that I wanted, you know, Dream Theater does doom, but there is a particular sort of style that surrounds that 8-string, and it just felt like it just sort of went to the wall. There was no, there wasn't anything really amazing about that. But the lyrics were so good for this track, you can't, you know, if the lyrics for this had have been on one of the other songs, you would have had an absolute knock it out of the park. Like if the lyrics were for this one were used for Transcending Time, for example, it just would have been completely different.
I feel like this lyric probably would have worked rather well if it were a ballad.
Yeah.
Like, imagine this song were the ballad.
Yeah.
Like, the lyrics would probably really work.
Mm.
And in fact, I'm going to throw the challenge out there. Hey, people of the internet, see if you can turn this into a ballad. See if you can make it work.
Challenge accepted.
I'd be really interested to hear it.
But I think, I genuinely, like, I mean, the lyrics were so good. I just, you know... And the way that they're sung, too, and the way that they work with that really works as well, you know. You know, the way that JLB actually sings them, particularly that last line of that last stanza I mentioned, you know, all along missing the point of the journey, and you just got this lovely resolve, and then there's a harmony bit that comes in. Oh, man, it's just that part of the song is gorgeous.
But actually, it didn't need the 8th Street.
It just didn't need to be there.
Yeah. Can we actually, while we're on this topic, can we just talk about James LaBrie's lyric, vocals? Not so much, okay.
Absolutely, we can.
Can we talk about the vocals for a second? Like, like people within the Dream Theater community, outside the Dream Theater community, imagine James LaBrie is this really high, shrieking kind of guy, right?
Yeah. Yep.
We don't get any of that on this record. There are no vocal gymnastics on this record. And I'm not saying really, that there should have been any either. Because they're probably, I can't think of any on the top of my head on the previous record. There was one bit on The Astonishing which fit the story, so I'll give that a pass.
Mm.
But I think his voice has settled down into more this sort of mid-range kind of sound. And I think maybe in some of the earlier records, they sort of felt the need to kind of take advantage of James's enormous vocal range and all the high stuff and all the rest of it, right? Now I don't think there's so much of that anymore. I think there's a definite thing to let's get him in the middle in that sort of mid-range tone that's really strong and powerful. Because frankly, let's face it, right? Most of James's high notes are gone now, yeah? It's just a function of time. Not Ebony and not anti him at all. It's just a function of time, right?
Yeah, it's getting on.
Yeah, he is. He's like, I'm not sure off the top of my head how old he is, but let's just say mid-50s, right?
He's mid-50s, yeah.
Yeah, right? The high stuff is like, no one can sing how they used to be able to in their 20s or their 30s, right? No. It just doesn't happen.
Jesus, I can't sing the way I used to sing 5 years ago. So
yeah, exactly. You look at all the big singers, right? You look at Fish, you look at Robert Plant, you look at Roger Daltrey, you look at John Anderson, you look at Geddy Lee, right?
Mm-hmm.
None of those guys can sing anywhere close to how they used to, you know, some further away than others, but they don't sing like how they used to back when they're 20s. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
The one person that I can think of that sort of kind of does sound like he does in his work is Roger Waters, but that's because he never had an enormous vocal range anyway, right?
No.
His vocal range was always pretty limited and he always sung inside it. Fantastic. Yeah. No problems there.
And even Paul McCartney, so, if you hear
Paul McCartney
now,
is another example as well, but same story.
Yeah, but I mean, if you take those two people now, there are a few strained notes and so on and so forth. Not really a whole big deal, and it sort of just adds to the rock thing.
Yeah, but the thing is, as well, we're talking about, you know, we're trying to compare James LaBrie, a man in his 50s, to guys who are now pushing 80.
Yes.
Right? The fact that those guys that were up until, you know, obviously not touring now, but were right up until the end of the pandemic, still out on the road and still touring when they're pushing 80 is bananas.
Absolutely.
You know, Roger Waters and Paul McCartney are both about the same age. They're both like 78 years old now, right? The fact that they're still going at all is bonkers.
Yeah. I don't know. But, I mean, I really enjoyed James's voice on this album. I really did. I'm just hoping he can pull it all off live. There was a lot of overdubbing. There was a lot of multi-harmony parts and so on and so forth. They play to a click nowadays, so they'll probably just have that in the background.
Oh, they've been playing to a click for years.
No, but now they actually use a lot of extra bits in behind and so on and so forth now.
Well, that's because that's just because they're trying to cover up for Mike Portnoy's absence in the backing vocals, right? John can't sing most of that stuff, so they trigger it.
Oh, John's voice has actually gotten a lot better. But they're also triggering a lot of other stuff as well.
But there are certain vocal points. Like, I remember when they played War Inside My Head on one of the previous tours. Like, you can clearly see they're triggering that call and answer thing from the keyboard. Like, there's a shot on one of the DVDs. John's not singing. There's a voice coming from somewhere, and it ain't him, and it ain't James. So that's coming from somewhere. It's coming from the keyboard.
So, yeah. But, I mean, I'm excited to see if they do it live. I would love to see that one live. Not for the 8-string, but for everything else. It's just amazing.
Maybe on the next record, once they get the 8-string thing happening a bit more, he's able to sort out the tones and maybe be able to do something a little bit more interesting.
Yeah, maybe.
But this just sounded like, it just sounded like John's got an 8-string, he brought a cool riff into the studio, everybody liked it, and they wrote a song around it.
Yeah, that's kind of what I think.
Which is pretty,
as well.
I know is pretty much how the Mirror happened. Like, it was that riff that came. Yeah, this is a popular thing in Dream. Yeah, he got the 7, and then he played that riff, the Puppies on Acid riff, and then it became the Mirror.
Yeah, I mean, it's
all right.
It's a great example of it, and maybe there will be development for it. Who knows? I'm excited to see what happens with it. But as it stands right now, didn't need to be there. All right. Title track. And have we saved the best for last?
Oh, boy. All right. God. Look, I know I shouldn't be so negative, but by this point in the record, we have now had the same intro pattern for half the record. Complex instrumental passage, melodic solo, chugging riff, lyrics begin. Like, at a certain point, it's just like, oh my god. And then, okay, I'm going to hang my hat on this one and say that this song is probably the worst one on the record for me.
Yep.
I mean, anyone who's listened to this show for any length of time will have heard me bitch mercilessly about some of the long-form songs on the previous records, about the Illumination Theory, and about the Count of Tuscany. I'm going to save you all from all of that. This song has committed all of the same sins that those two have as well. Mm. Right down to the bass interlude that leads into the second verse, then the string section in the middle. Mm. I remember when on the first pass through this record, when I literally raged at this point with my wife, and I was like, oh, for fuck's sake, you guys couldn't come up with anything different for the middle section to this?
Yeah.
You'd like to think that at some point someone in the band would have said, hey, haven't we done this before?
Mm-hmm.
Because so far as I can work out, this is their third pass through the string section in the middle of the long song.
Yep.
Okay, the first time they did it with, like, the pedal steel and the volume pedal on the guitar, fine, whatever. Then they did the Illumination Theory, and I will still stand to this day that section is twice as long as it needs to be. And then we get to this one, and I'm just like, at this point, I'm done.
Look, to be fair, at least it was real instruments this time around. It was a beautiful, I think it was a viola, I think. May have been a
cello.
They
used real strings on the Illumination Theory too. It didn't make it sound any more interesting.
No, but this was interesting because it was kind of like a lead thing, and, my concern with it is, I suppose, what does it look like live? Right?
It looked like it did with the Illumination Theory.
What,
a bunch
shit?
Of people standing, yeah, a bunch of people standing around in a hall for 3.5 minutes waiting for the band to come back on stage.
Yeah,
that's it.
It was. Oh, that's so brutal, but it's so true.
Well, that's what it was. That's what it was. It was me in the middle on the front row next to you waiting for the band to come back.
It was
when I saw the Count of Tuscany live. It was me going, okay, you've looped through this section twice. Can you just roll through this so we can finish the song up and you can get to your encore already?
I actually liked
That's a lie. That was the encore.
I was going to say, that was the encore. I actually liked the Count of Tuscany. I think it's a great track. And it was the first time that Petrucci had committed that volume swell to record, right? So it was interesting in that was the case. And it is really, really cool. But looking back on it now, that was kind of like the start of the symptoms. You know what I mean? And surely someone should have probably, and this is where the producer thing comes in, it's like, do that live. Like, keep that out, but do that live. Can we just go straight into the next bit? Is that, and then, you can do it live and so on and so forth. And then there's something to add. And I actually really liked the way they did it in the Count of Tuscany, the way they did it live, because there was more gain and there was this feedback that was fucking beautiful. I remember the end of that. You know, there was this huge feedback thing and then like a dive bomb down, and because of the amount of delay he had going, it like swirled around the it was the Horton Pavilion. It was beautiful. It was gorgeous. It was, oh man, I really liked that. Didn't really need to be on the album though, but you know, you kind of get away with it. But now it's just becoming like this thing where, oh yeah, we've got a 20-minute track. Yeah, how many minutes of that is like just people pushing buttons? Because that's retarded. Like I didn't. I'm coming here to see the five of you play, not to watch a screen show me shapes.
Yeah.
The other thing I want to ask you as well is, there were a couple of things on this particular song. First and foremost, Metropolis opening.
Yeah.
With an orchestra. Okay. We've seen that before. The rhythm was really, really crazy. You know, that'll be a bitch to play live, I'll guarantee it. But then it's like, yeah, I'm looking at my watch going, can we fucking get on with this, guys? Like, is this a... You know, they could have brought the full band in a lot quicker. But it's not bad. Like, it's not bad. It's just, you know, you're sort of going, come on, get to the part. When the band hits, it doesn't really feel like it hits. Everyone just comes in and it's like, oh, okay. You know, it's not like a fuck, you know, it's not this big release. There's no volume increase. There's no anything. Like when you, in other albums, when, you know, everyone comes back in and there's, and it's like, yeah, it hits really hard, you know. The lyrics are some of the weakest on the entire album. You know, it's a pretty huge prog epic with some really great moments and some other amazing bits in it, and the lyrics are really self-serving.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to the lyrics for this song, I literally have no notes.
It's, like, I mean,
none at all.
It's just, they're really average.
Maybe the problem is here, and like, we have spent a lot of time on this podcast dissecting great lyrics. I'm going to name check four of them off the top of my head that I know that we have spent quite a lot of time talking about. We spent a lot of time talking about Einar Solberg's lyrics.
Yep.
We spent way longer than we probably should have dissecting Fish's lyrics, but I will stand by that because, like, the music in itself is very much in service of the lyrics, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Whereas with the Dream Theater record, the music is very much in service of itself, and the lyrics just happen to be there.
Yes.
The other one that we spent a lot of time talking about is Malcolm Galloway's lyrics, which I will stand up as he's probably one of the best going around at the moment in terms of, like, lyrics and story writing. And the other one, which we haven't actually gotten around to talking about, but I will still hold up as one of the better ones,
mm-hmm.
is Steve Hogarth's lyrics. I mean, we've talked about Morellian on this podcast to death, so... But there's, like, those are the four that we've probably spent... We've spent a lot of time talking about lyrics and really dissecting lyrics and looking at what they mean and all the rest of it. And with this, I have no notes. There's just... there's just nothing here to really delve into. And, like, oh, what's that mean? Or what's that? It's just like, eh.
Mm.
It just left me feeling cold. I don't know.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. Yeah, then you get into the middle section of this song and it's straight out of A Change of Seasons. You know, you've got then that viola coming in. It needs something over it to keep listeners' attention, as we were just mentioning. A happy change there would have been a really nice welcome change instead of the melancholic lyrics that we get when James finally comes back in. You know, he starts singing over the melancholic bit again instead of over that really nice, hopeful Lydian part of the song. You know, but then that leads into a lovely little solo, which screams of A Change of Seasons again. And then lyrics in the middle and more solos. And it's like, fucking, how many... At this point, it's like you've had four solos, John. Fucking step back, let someone else have a bit of the limelight.
Yeah, the only thing that's missing now is, like, a bass solo, and you've pretty much got the whole card.
Yeah, exactly. Now... I will say this third section of the song, that is a fucking huge riff. It's simple, but it's massive. And you're like, yeah, okay, cool. This is cool. This is really, really awesome. It's super interesting to my ears. And then we're off to solo land again. And I mean, at this point, this is a Dream Theater album, right? This is not another JP solo album. Like, you know... and then, oh, wait, no, yes, there is, because here comes JR with a solo as well. It's like, fucking hell, guys. Like, you're following the same thing.
Yeah.
And then you get section four, which is straight out of the Ministry of Lost Souls. And then, you know, probably with a bit of ACOS thrown in. And lyrics, melancholy, hopeful part with doubling and guitar parts. And then the song ends with the same rundown from 6 Degrees, that run around the fucking Toms thing. And then it does the all starts again thing that happened at the end of Octavarium. And I was like, are you fucking kidding me? You guys have got 32 odd years of experience behind you as a band, and that's the best that you come up with.
Apparently.
Like, this is your epic. Are you fucking joking?
With Distance Over Time, it's like, okay, cool. The longest song on this record was about 9 and a bit minutes. I thought, great. Maybe they're done with the epics. Right? They've done them on a bunch of records now. They all... It's like, okay, maybe they're done with that sort of thing. Maybe if they do another epic, it could be like 6 Degrees of Time, like a multi-part thing following a bigger thing.
100%.
But... Yep. No, they end up with this, and I'm just like, ugh.
I know.
I know.
It's disheartening, and it's heartbreaking as a massive Dream Theater fan. I mean, these guys got me through really rough times at school, right? I got the shit kicked out of me at school for being a nerd, basically. You know, and
it's a typical experience of the sort of people that we are, unfortunately.
Absolutely. And I mean, you had it won over me because you liked sport. I didn't even have that as a saving grace.
Yeah, but I liked it, but I wasn't good at it, I assure you. Trust me. I still can't hold a cricket bat properly and swing the thing for any runs. Trust me.
But you know, I mean, it's really disheartening to have these tracks come up and this new one, it's like, oh yeah, it's an epic, it's going to be awesome, and it's fucking not. It's like,
I honestly
they're a shadow
wonder.
Of their former self, you know.
Yeah, we can get to that part in a minute, but it's like, when people are like, oh wow, there's an epic on the record, did anyone out there, and I'm asking legitimately, get in touch with us if you really thought this, did anyone honestly think this epic was going to be any good?
I had my hopes.
Like,
I'll be honest, yeah? I had my hopes, absolutely. Because, I mean, they've done
maybe
such
I'm
great
just...
stuff in the past, and you know, the Distance Over Time was such a good album, and I was like, okay, cool. So if they took everything that they learnt that was great about that album, and then they sort of rammed it into one song, that could be fucking cool, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe,
I was going to say, my answer to that question that I just asked was like, you know, I think, like, maybe I'm getting too cynical. Maybe I'm just getting burnt out on the whole situation, something we can talk about later on if you like. But I honestly didn't think this one was going to... the epic thing, and I'm like, oh yeah, here we go. I think I even said to my wife, oh, they're going to do an epic. I wonder if there's going to be a classical section in the middle. And they bloody did it!
Well, that was the thing. I mean, pulling back the curtain a little bit, when we were talking about it a couple of episodes ago, maybe off-air, I can't remember if it was, you and I had a bet. And we were like, fucking case of beer if they have a stupid fucking...
I think it was on the air.
I think it was. And it was like, hey, you know, a case of beer if they have it. And I said, no, I don't think they'll do it. I owe you a case of beer.
All right, then.
You know, it's just like the whole thing is fucked.
I was going to say, this bet is now a lot easier to fulfill now that we both live in the same city. So, yeah.
Exactly.
I'm not sure if it was on the air or whether we did it sort of privately off air and via messages or something.
Oh, it was. I remember messaging you when we got the album.
Yeah.
I was listening. I was actually in quarantine when we were listening to it. And I was
That's right.
So does One Viola class, is that a classical section? Like,
Yeah. Does One Viola count as the classical section? And I think I said yes, obviously, because I was about to win a case of beer.
But I mean, that was the whole thing, you know, and I don't know. Look, let's jump on, because there were a couple of questions that we didn't get to answer.
Yes, this is now, and we can sort of summarize around this. I'm like, so there was a question from Andrew Welshby about Jordan's new sounds and how they will contribute to the album themes. Like, I don't know about you, Dave, but yeah, if we assume that Ebo guitar thing we were talking about earlier is actually a keyboard, that's probably the only one.
I mean,
everything else is pretty much something we've already heard.
Look, they're probably all new sounds. Knowing what JR does, they're probably all new sounds, and he's built particular sounds for this and that and the other thing and blah, blah, blah. Are they really out in front, holy shit, new sounds, though? No, they're not. They're just kind of new sounds, you know, but they kind of serve the same purposes as the other ones.
There's no new lead sounds, as far as I can tell. They're all the same kind of lead sounds. And all the other stuff, it kind of has to serve a purpose, right? It's either adding color with piano or organ, or it's just beefing up guitar sounds. Yeah. Like, there's some heavy synth sound, you know, all that Snarling Pig or whatever he's using, right? That's beefing the guitar sound, right?
Yep.
Pretty much it.
The thing is, and this is where I come back to the whole idea of having another producer in there, right, is you need someone to say, I'm sorry, you did that before, let's do something different. What else have you got in your bag of tricks there? Show us. And then they hear something, and the band goes, oh, I don't like that. And the producer goes, no, this could probably work. And then they put it in, they give it a go, and everyone goes, oh, shit, actually, that does work. The amount of times that has happened to me in a studio is mind-boggling. I am a reasonable musician. I have a music degree. I know how shit goes together. But, you know, people coming up with ideas and a producer going, hey, why don't you try it this way? And then I try it, and I'm like, no, that's ridiculous. Why would I use that amp? That's fucking retarded. That's dumb. No, I want to use my amazing amplifier that I've worked my ass off for, and it's everything. And then he pulls this thing out, and I play with it, and I'm like, yeah, all right, fuck, it works. You know, you got to, that's the problem. There isn't, because they're sort of an entity unto their own now, they're kind of just going to keep repeating the same things, and no one fucking wants that, you know?
Well, maybe, but this is the question, leads to the next question that we have, the question from Paul Graves, which I think we'll summarize this review and then we'll finally get out of it.
Yep.
Is this album just another Dream Theater record, or is it a highlight, i.e. something that can be mentioned alongside Images and Words, Awake, Scenes from Memory, etc.? Unfortunately, no. This is very much the former. Is that because, as I mentioned a bit earlier, it's like the follow-up Blues, the Somewhere Else to Marbles, the South of Heaven to Rain in Blood, so to speak, right?
Yeah.
It could be. You know, because everybody liked that record, and it was so good, and then anything going on afterwards, and everybody's just like, you know, it's not, you know, it's just not as good.
Mm.
There's parts of this record I like, some of the lyrics raise interesting themes, but there's really nothing that gets me charged and excited like Distance Over Time did. Nothing that, as I keep mentioning, gives me the fizz.
Yeah, there are parts that I love, 100%. Yes. There are parts that I love. And even, like, Transcending Time, I actually really enjoy that song. I like listening to that song. I would put that song on at a party in a playlist and things like that, and watch as everyone stares at the speakers as to wondering what the fuck this rock music is doing on the radios. But, you know, I like that song, but 1 out of 7, or 6, or however many it is that there are on this album.
There are 7.
There are 7? Good, I got it right. You know, 1 out of 7, ugh, you know, I mean, yeah, okay, The Alien's a cool track, but I'm not going to listen to it on repeat. Like, it's all right, but it's not brilliant. And to directly answer the question from Paul, can it be mentioned alongside Images and Words, Awake, Scenes from a Memory, for me, Octavarium? Absolutely not.
No.
No. And that's rough. It's really, really rough to say that. And maybe we're just being the types of people that, you know, never enough people. I don't know. You know, I have possible. To acknowledge, you know, I was having a chat with a mate of mine last night, and we were talking about how your tastes develop and they change, and it's not just your tastes that change, but it's also the artists' tastes that change, what they want to put out and so on and so forth. And you can't begrudge them for that.
I was talking about earlier with Stephen Wilson, yeah? It was like he wants to do the pop stuff, and I don't want to hear the pop stuff.
Yeah, and that's fine. Right. And these guys obviously want to do the things that... This album obviously means a lot to them, because they wouldn't be doing it if it didn't, right? And I want to make it absolutely abundantly clear, I don't begrudge the band for putting an album out like this, because obviously it's their album, it's what they want to hear and so on and so forth, and I appreciate that, and I like that. I like the fact that that's what they're doing. But, I mean, as a fan, I just feel like, I genuinely feel like this is sort of, maybe they've got one more album left in them.
What you mean, you like know, one more good one, like one more really good one, you mean, or one more decent one?
Yeah, one more decent one, and then it's sort of all done. I tend to agree with you. I feel like the album was rushed. Because I mean, it's suspicious that most of the tracks are like 10 minutes. You know, normally you would have, you know, a track that was 6 minutes and then one that was like 11 minutes and then one was like 7 minutes. And, you know, the average track length might be 10, but the vast majority of it's not, because you've cut and you've taken bits out and you've put things in and all that kind of stuff. You know, I want to make it absolutely clear. Whilst Hoggy is not bagging this record, I'm suggesting it's not the best Dream Theater album around. And as I've said, I don't think it's an album. Genuinely, I actually think it's a bad album. Not because it's the songs and the contents are bad, but it's not really an album. It feels like a collection of singles. It doesn't feel like a new album with, you know, the start to finish kind of way that the dare I say, the feng shui of an actual album, you know, that flow that goes through the album and so on and so forth. It just kind of feels like they've gone, righto, here's 7 new songs, just ram them on there and hope it's all right. You know? And maybe that's
the
rough,
other thing,
but...
Yeah, I was going to say, that's the other thing is as well, it's like, it's still a good record, but I just wonder if the well is starting to run dry. And mm-hmm. yes, we fully recognize that we, you and I, are being critical of a band that's doing a record in probably what's going to amount, looking back retrospectively, either the top two or the top three toughest times as a band, right? The Falling Into Infinity sessions, you know, much has been made of that, and John said, oh no, it really wasn't as bad as we thought it was, whatever, right? Mm-hmm. Finding a right replacement for Charlie Dominici, and then this, like trying to, what the hell's going to happen to our industry with this pandemic, right?
Absolutely.
The whole thing's gone off the air for 18 months, right? It's really a very hard time for the band, and it's very harsh of us to be very critical of this record.
Mm.
So I tried to temper my criticism of this record a lot here. Because there's plenty at play. There's lots of moving parts and different factors here.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I tried. It would have been... here's the thing. And this has always been the underpinning of this entire podcast for the whole time. It's really easy to come in and bag a record. It's
absolutely
really easy to jump in and just say everything's shit. Right? Yeah. But we don't try not to do that.
Mm.
Sometimes it's unavoidable, like when we're greeted with what I thought was actually going to be a really interesting record, like the Swappers 11 record. I thought that was going to be really interesting, and it just turned out to be like a really bad Marillion cover band.
Yeah.
Like just a bad second. And like I tried to like that record so much because there's something really earnest here about it, but just the execution of it was wrong.
Oh, absolutely.
And so... like, let that be the marker for the, like, if everyone wants to think about the, like, the retrospective. It's like, we've tried to say good things and try to be, you know, give positive things.
Mm.
It's not easy. It's really sometimes not that easy.
Mm.
Like, it's really easy to just go full in and bag a record.
Absolutely.
And we've tried not to do that. Whether or not we've succeeded, well, that's for you guys to judge.
Absolutely. And I mean, at the end of the day, we're nothing if not honest.
Well, the other part of it as well is because, and like, this should be no secret to anybody, right? Both Dave and I are big diehard Dream Theater fans, right?
Mm.
There's a very, very thin line between love and hate. Right?
Oh, absolutely.
And it really doesn't take very much in these sorts of situations to turn from one to the other. Right? It's like, I'm going to use a sports analogy here. It's like a very, like, you know, when I remember there was like a big scandal back in the English Premier, like apparently Wayne Rooney was going to sign for another club. He was going to leave the only club he'd ever played for, Manchester United, and he was going to go to another club.
Mm-hmm.
And there were people outside his house with picket signs. And he was getting booed in games and stuff because everyone thought he was about to leave. Spoiler alert, he didn't. But there's that fine line again. People either worshipped him as like the greatest guy to put on the boots for Manchester United, probably. Yeah. I'm not that big of a fan of soccer, so I can't really tell, right? Or people are booing him and picketing outside his house. So it's that fine line between the two.
You're only as good as your last scandal. you're exactly right. And as massive Dream Theater fans, I mean, we run the fucking fan club of Australia and New Zealand, for God's sake, right? We have done a lot over the years to try and help you know, Dream Theater have good tours and promoting it and so on and so forth. So it's we love the band. We love the guys in the band. They've been so generous with their time, you know, from, you know, people calling you and speaking to you from Greece, you know, John Petrucci having sat down with me like three times, interviewing Mangini and Rudess numerous times, now John Myung as well. You know, we know a lot of the guys in the community as well, know a lot of the people who are their, you know, their booking managers and their heads of the big fan clubs and all that kind of stuff. And inevitably, we're going to get called out and we're going to be the guys that, it's, oh, you know, you can't really say that. And you know what? Cool. Change our mind. I'm fine with that. If you want to send us an email and tell us why we're wrong, go for it.
Or the people that are just going to sit there and bag us and call us haters. And it's like, well, yeah. No, that's not true. We're not haters.
No, no. And that's the thing. You know? We don't hate what Dream Theater... I mean, I am in a minority, right? In that I love Falling Into Infinity and everyone's like, oh, it's a shit album. And it's like, but it's actually... It's not. Logically, it's not. You know, I like Black Clouds and Silver Linings. I like Systematic Chaos. I think they're actually really good albums.
But here's the thing, right? I think every single time, like we talked, like the Falling Into Infinity thing was a little bit outside the thing. People sort of perceive it to be this sort of step towards commercialism, and whether or not it's not, I mean, who cares, right? Mm-hmm. But it was reacted to negatively by the fans. People didn't like that record. They did it again years later with The Astonishing. They tried something different. It didn't. The fans didn't like it. So I think every time they've tried to step outside the thing and do something a little bit different, it just gets met with this like. Stonewall from the fans of like, we don't like it. And I think genuinely at the core of it, the Dream Theater fan community, as I know it's really hard to like simplify like a large fan community down to like a monolith, but I'm gonna try anyway. Ultimately, at the end of the day, there is a reasonably large core of the fan base that do not want to hear anything other than what they've just put out.
Yeah
And no, I agree ultimately with you. You and I are probably slightly on the outer of that. That we're like, well, no, we're not here to hear the same. Probably you say more than me. It will probably be me more so than you, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Like, trying to listen for different things or trying to find different sounding stuff while still retaining the core of what they are.
Yeah.
Like, ultimately, like, what we, you and I, want out of this band, we're not going to get. And we either need to be cool with that or just stop talking about them.
I think that's the thing. Like, we are... I think both of us are okay with that, you know? But that doesn't necessarily mean that we can't talk about the new album. You know, we can't talk about this and what they've done and so on.
And
so
also
forth,
that we can't be disappointed about it either.
100%. You know, I mean, It's rough. Like, it is really rough. You know, I don't know. I'm a bit at odds as to what to say about it. But, yeah. On that note.
Yeah, I was going to say, maybe we should
move on to our other album reviews.
Indeed. Let's just park that conversation there and move on to our album reviews. Alrighty, so the record that I gave to you, Dave, was by an artist called Kate Pass. The record was called Cohesia. What'd you think of that?
Oh, how did I know you were going to give me another jazz-inspired album?
You've got another one coming up this week too, by the way.
Oh, of course I do. This is a fucking cool album. Great horn work. It's really, really good horn section in it. And some amazing and really, really good rhythm section behind it as well. Yeah, the drummer and the double bassist. Just, oof, really, really nice stuff. I've said it before on the show and I'll say it again. The saxophone is the sexiest instrument alive. I don't care what anyone else says and I will fight you on it. Internet strangers, if you at me about it, you're all wrong. It's great. But no, it's great. I really enjoyed it. I would definitely have it on, you know, while I'm cooking dinner. You know, I'd have it on when I had a dinner party and so on and so forth. Like, it's actually a nice, it's nice background music, but it's also, if you want to sink your teeth into it, there's a lot there to unpack. So really, really, really cool. So two thumbs up from me. Definitely listen to that one again. Hoggy, I gave you When the Skies Are Grey by A Dying Planet. What'd you think?
Well, that's interesting. When I first started listening to this record, I figured it was an Australian band mixed and or mastered by Forrester Savile. Because there's so much of an Australian metal influence in this record. I often talk about Mid-Atlantic records on this show, you know, stuff that's sort of, you know, English guys aping up the American sound or American guys aping up the English sound, a bit like Great Wide Nothing, that band, right?
Yep.
This record is very much what I'm going to refer to as a Mid-Pacific record.
Yeah.
These guys are from LA, so there's that LA sort of American sound to it, but there's obviously a lot of influence from the Australian bands here. So, I mean, the record itself, I mean, if you like Australian prog metal, Carnival, Cog, Butterfly Effect, I'm sure they're the they're probably the influences here, you'll probably like this record. It's a debut record from a new band made from established artists, so it'll be interesting to see if they develop things further or kind of stick to that, again, that mid-Pacific sound, or whether they go more towards Australia or more towards America with it. So what have you got for me this week, Dave?
I have a brand new release for you. The album is called Inhumanity, and the band is called Anyone. So check that out. Let me know what you think.
Alrighty. So the record that I've got for you, I've already teased what this record is. It's another one of these jazz-inspired records that I want a bit of a kick on at the moment. We're going to talk about that again, but we're going to leave that for the after show, because this main show now has been rolling for nearly an hour and a half, and we probably should wrap it up.
Yep.
So the record that I have for you is called... This is a debut record by a band out of London, released earlier this year. It's called For the First Time by a band called Black Country New Road. Check it out. Tell me what you think.
Absolutely will. Awesome. Well, that about wraps the podcast up. It wraps our review of Dream Theater's new album up as well. It's coming out in the coming days, 22nd of October. Get excited. Or maybe after hearing this, don't. You know, whatever. However it works.
Absolutely. If you would like to find the the show notes for this episode, you can find them at the98podcast.fireside.fm/78. You can find us on Twitter at 98FM. But until next time, Dave, my name is Alex Hogg.
My name is David Ellis. We'll see you at the very next time you put us in your ear holes.